All right, well, let's get this panel underway, and we'll get chairs for the panelists at one point. And, yeah, a lot of us were surprised to see that our room was so small, so it's going to be standing room only, but that's okay because this panel's all supposed to be about audience interaction, so it should work for us. My name is Paul Proctor, and David Mortman and I have helped put this panel together. We have a number of panelists. I'll be showing you them in a second. I've got notes here on my computer, which I don't want to broadcast to you, but we'll put that up, and we'll have all the panelists introduce themselves here in just a second. I want to tell you a little bit about how this panel came about. It was put together essentially to address the issues in disclosure which have not been solved. So one of the things we did was we got vendors, we got end users, and we got researchers together to discuss the issues, and what we want to do is uncover the issues. And rather than sitting here and David and I trying to tell you what we learned during the panel, we're going to let the panelists do that throughout. But there was a few comments that were made. Sorry, I should point out that, let me back up a step. This morning we had a private session, which included the people that you see up here, and we basically hashed through the issues. And we've put together some topics, which I'll be showing you in a second, and we're going to go through those topics this afternoon. So having said that, let me go back to the fact that we captured a couple of comments that we want to say an overview about this issue, and then we'll show you the topics. We'll have the panelists introduce themselves. I want to encourage everybody. I want to see hands shooting up and people talking, because that is definitely what this panel is about. We're in a small enough room. I don't think we have microphones to put out in the audience, so I would ask you to please speak up, and we'll repeat the comments or questions as necessary. Okay, so a lot of the issues relate to when to disclose and how much information to disclose. One of the things that we discovered this morning is a number of dimensions to this problem that relate to both how big and small the vendors are. See a little bit more about that in a second, but also how big and small the enterprises are. For instance, one of the things we came up with, a topic which we'll be covering and a theme which ran throughout, is that when the end users were talking, a lot of it related to risk management. This is no longer about protecting yourselves as much as you can. So in other words, there's no longer an assumption that if a patch becomes available, if a vulnerability is disclosed, enterprises no longer take the perspective of, we got to get out there and patch immediately. So this goes to the large enterprises in particular take a risk management approach. The smaller enterprises tend to look at it as a, just tell me if I need to do something and I'll go do it and be done with it. So you're going to see that coming up as we talk. Big and small vendors. One of the things we discovered and one of the comments that was made this morning was that the top 10 ISVs pretty much have this figured out. They understand how to do disclosure, how to work with the researchers. However, there were three vendors that came up in particular, and this was in the context of sort of the seven stages of going through grief and where you're at in dealing with vulnerability disclosure as a vendor. And we discovered that Microsoft is pretty much in the acceptance stage. Microsoft works pretty well with the vendors. They figured it out, and they're doing it. Now, Cisco, on the other hand, where's John? I don't want to get hit. Good, he's over there. Cisco, we figured, is moving out of the anger stage and into the acceptance stage.
Hi, I'm John. I'm an alcoholic.
Yes.
You're in the meetings, too?
Now, Oracle, on the other hand... Oracle, on the other hand, we have determined that they seem to be moving out of the denial stage and into the anger stage. So just you can think about that as sort of tiers of how the vendors take care of this. But on the most part, the large ISVs are starting to say, yes, vulnerabilities are important. We need to address them. We need to work with the community. And then finally, I would say that we did get a lot of end user perspective. I was pushing that on people quite heavily to know always how does this impact the end users. And one comment was made that the ones that are disclosed, we don't care about those. The operationalization of security has pushed the patches down. I mean, ops does that. They come out, they test them, they deploy them. It's a process. It's taken care of. Security, on the whole, is worried about the things that they don't know about. Where are the risk areas that might actually be causing a problem? So from a disclosure perspective, the point was made that what we need is more disclosure because we can't fix something or deal with something that we don't know about. Now, you're going to find that theme comes back. Let me go ahead and do you want to add any comments while I'm...
I'll jump in.
Here. Go ahead. You comment while I bring up the...
Bring up the slides that you comment on.
Okay.
One leads to the other. Or do you want to do something?
Oh, why don't we introduce ourselves? You go first.
Okay, we're going to actually move on to introductions of our panelists. I'm David Mortman. I used to be the Chief Information Security Officer for Siebel Systems.
I'm Michael Sutton. I'm the Director of iDefense Labs.
Just making this all the way around. Or
you guys should use your own mics rather than
that. I can just yell. I hope you can hear me. I'm Derek Scholl. I manage the team that handles everything having to do with security vulnerability bugs at Sun Microsystems.
My name is David Lesfield. I'm the Chief Research Officer from NGS Software in the UK.
I'm Raymond Alder. I'm here without my employer's hat on.
And I'm Scott Blake. I'm the CISO of Liberty Mutual Insurance, although the opinions expressed are not necessarily those of my employer.
Go ahead.
Pamela Fusco, and I'm here as well as a former Chief Information Security Officer and current Information Security Executive.
Dave Goldsmith. I'm the President of Modisano Security. I also do a lot of research stuff, too.
And you can't see this, but it actually says, in for the squeaking Tom Tachik. Tom lost his voice. He participated in the panel this morning, but he's doing a fine job. He'll get up here if he really needs to start squeaking at you vigorously. John, go ahead.
John Stewart, Vice President, Chief Security Officer, Cisco Systems.
And Steve Lipner, Director of Security Engineering Strategy at Microsoft and formerly Head of the Security Response Center at Microsoft.
Jerry Dixon, U.S. CERT, Homeland Security.
So I'd like to kick us off by saying that, see, we have Cisco standing next to Microsoft, and nobody is wasting nobody. Did somebody
it's
get that
a sad
on
day, a very sad day.
Did somebody get that on a camera phone? All right, so here's our topics. These are the things that came out. We basically went through 2 hours of vigorous discussion about the topic. These are the things that surfaced. When to disclose. What I'm going to do is hit all seven of these, and then we're going to come back, and we're going to go through them one at a time, and we'll hit the panelists. So when to disclose and what to disclose, probably the key issue in this whole debate. Disclosure, does it work? We actually came up with some examples this morning about how the evolution of disclosure has led to some good examples of how it's actually benefiting. And we'll talk about that. Parity. This came up particularly from the vendor's perspective, well, actually from the vendor's and the end user's perspective, is in disclosure, should there be a preferred list? And we're going to want your opinions about that because certainly the panel has some good ones. So should some people get early information, larger enterprises, backbone providers, people that might be in a position to be at more risk? Third-party fixes. This also generated a lot of good discussion about should you get your fixes from somebody other than the vendor? Should you trust them? Should you use them? So we'll be interested in hearing about whether you do that. The impact of paying for vulnerabilities. There's a number of programs out there for researchers actually making money by disclosing those to various parties, and we'll get into that. And then finally, believe it or not, I referred to this at the end of the day as the golden goose of panel discussion because it generated the most discussion and the least agreement. And you'll see this. We're going to leave the most time at the end as we go through these. I'm going to try to leave. We're in here for another hour and 15 minutes, and we're going to try to leave at least 20, 25 minutes at the end to discuss this topic. What happens if you have a vulnerability without a good fix or workaround to disclose or not to disclose? So with that, let's go ahead and hit this first topic, when to disclose and what to disclose. And I know that one perspective was given this morning, which was essentially what I regarded as sort of old school thought, which was, hey, you're a researcher. You're the one that found the information. Shouldn't it be up to you to disclose whatever you want, whenever you want? So why don't we start there? So who wants to start us off? And you guys that are standing, and sorry for that, you guys can pick up those mics out of the stands and use them until we get chairs in here.
Just sit on the table.
I'm not so sure I trust the table.
Steve's trying to comment.
Yeah, no, Steve's just trying to get the mic out. I mean, but I'll comment. It's the finder finds the information, and it's his or hers to do with as they wish. But we believe that, you know, I believe at least that the best thing for the user community who we're all attempting to protect is some sort of a coordinated disclosure in which the developer has a chance to address the problem before details go out widely.
No, actually, I took that down because I'm going to bring up other notes and comments. We're not going to be displaying the topics throughout. That was pretty much the only thing. We'll come back to the topics one at a time.
Agreeing with Steve in that respect, from a researcher's point of view, we as the researcher have the small picture. Let's say we find one bug. The vendor is armored with all the extra information surrounding that. And there could be a larger issue right next to the issue that, you know, the research found. And then in disclosing that without coordination in the vendor, you could open up a larger can of worms than you initially anticipated. So I'm in complete agreement with Steve because the vendor has the larger picture.
I think that for the most part, we're going to have agreement on the fact that it's a good thing for the end user community if the vendor has an opportunity to make that patch. I'd actually like to throw another question out to the panel. What about a situation where you have a vendor who's unresponsive who will not produce a patch? When is it appropriate to disclose, or is it ever appropriate to disclose?
I mean, I think this is a really tough one, right? Because from a researcher perspective, you're often put in a situation, and sometimes one of the things I think is also difficult to understand is a lot of times when we think of researchers, we're only thinking of people that are independent third-party researchers. But let's include people that find vulnerabilities in software as just a general categorization. And maybe they work for companies that are enterprises. Maybe they're working for companies that are independent researchers. It depends. But I think one of the challenges here is if it's not getting fixed, you know, how what other means are really available to address it. And I think, you know, one of the things that got addressed in the intro was the idea that, you know, the vulnerability disclosure community or the vulnerability community came from a place where it was commonplace to just post, right? It wasn't even necessarily coordinate with the vendor, even communicate with the vendor, except through BugTrack. That would pretty much be how you told the vendor that there's a vulnerability in their software. And that started to evolve. People started to talk to vendors. But it was difficult in the beginning. There was a lot of transition for vendors to take researchers seriously, which is how we ended up in a situation where there was a culture at all that said it's okay to publish vulnerability information and exploits, right? That's another thing that used to be really common for anyone doing research. Exploits came right along with it on BugTrack. If you read the archives of BugTrack, you did not see a lot of advisories that were just advisories like we see today, where they say, you know, here's the risk, here's where you get the patch. It was, here's the risk and here's the exploit. Good luck. So I don't know. I don't know what you do when you're sitting on vulnerabilities for 9 months to a year. And actually, my company's in that situation right now. This might be a great point to ask other people in the audience about. You know, what do you do when you're sitting on, say, 30-plus advisories across 10-plus vendors with remote command execution vulnerabilities that affect tens of thousands of hosts inside of every enterprise? And you know, we just want to see the problems fixed more than anything, and we have zero leverage, right? Also it's a question for vendors. You know, what are the incentives to fix it if the rules of the game are you don't disclose unless there's a patch?
I mean, if you're really looking out, so to speak, for the common good, and you're not getting progress with the vendor, you know, I would hope. You know, I think we've been effective at US CERT and helping to apply pressure to the vendors to, you know, to move them along. You know, we always caveat that too, you know, under, you know, what we call responsible disclosure. You know, if there is a active exploitation stuff, then, you know, we're going to be communicating a little, you know, a little bit faster than what we normally would. But, you know, I think the key thing there is that the vendors do need to kind of own that problem. And I think, you know, it might be a good segue into the third-party fix discussion as well. When, you know, researchers come up with the capability, you know, if there is a time gap and the vendor's not responsive, and we've seen historically instances of that where, you know, the researcher or another group comes up with a third-party fix, you know, do organizations go about applying that? You know, again, I think it'd be a good discussion for some of the end users here.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, just to comment on my own question, that I think fortunately it's in this day and age, it's a very rare circumstance when that occurs now. I mean, you know, things have changed a lot in the last 5 years. And so vendors do typically take security issues quite seriously. You know, my perspective on that is that it would be a very rare situation when you should proceed with disclosure, but that can occur that a vendor simply will not produce a patch. They've told you that they won't. And so to answer that question, I put myself in the end user's shoes. What would I want? It's never a desirable situation when a vulnerability goes out without a patch, but as an end user, there comes a point when I have a right to know about it, even if there's not a patch, even if it's because I want to know that that vendor doesn't take security seriously and I need to find another vendor. But I think from a researcher's standpoint, you have to go to great lengths before you would ever reach that point.
And actually, on that note, I have a question for our panel or audience members who have an opinion on this is, we talked earlier this morning about how the top 10 ISVs are actually pretty good at doing security these days, but I'm curious how you're managing those other ISVs who you have in your environments that may be just as pervasive as the top 10 ISVs, and how do you push them or leverage them to being more proactive about security?
I think we had a comment at the back. Giant green shirt.
It's gonna.
Is anybody on the panel in favor of full disclosure?
Define that.
Yeah, well, yeah. Define full disclosure.
We agree on what full disclosure actually is.
That's,
you know,
the issue.
Like, you mean just once you find a vulnerability, release full details without going to the vendor?
You find the problem, and you make it known.
Huh. So we discussed this morning at 7 a.m. when they made us get up for our panel discussion before we got here. So we're probably not as sharp.
And I'll point out you were late.
He's such a girl, you know? God, why do I bother?
It's true. I have better hair than you, too.
Sorry. So I think, for me, anyway, as a user, per se, in an enterprise solution, it is, what is the vulnerability that we're looking at? Is it massive? If it's massive, then, yeah, I think we need to know. If it's, you know, baby candy, don't bother me with it, because it's not something that I need to be woken up for in the middle of the night. But then there's this other side. If it's a massive exploit or vulnerability that's pending that we don't know about in the world or publicly, whatever, and the majority of industries or private users or end users are using this particular software or the service, then in fact, you know, we need to know. It could be a pandemic situation, of course, but we're all in the same boat at that point, right? So whether the good guys know where the bad guys go, it's kind of like Y2K. The banks are closed. Nobody gets money. So it doesn't matter if it's under your mattress or not. So I'm kind of in that boat there. If it's that big, then we do need to know. Because everyone's going to know anyway, and we're all in the same situation. So how much worse could it really get?
Yeah, I think most of the research that I do is on backbone security and backbone vulnerabilities. And so if I were to just, you know, take whatever I did and throw it out on full disclosure without going to the vendor and being nice with them, then, you know, my internet breaks. I'm not real happy about that. So because of the nature of the area of my research, I do my best to work with the vendors when at all possible. I mean, other than that, if I have to, but I devoutly hope to never get to that point again.
We have a comment over here.
Yeah, one comment, one question. Comment. What's baby candy? How many times have I seen that baby candy turn into a full remote exploit, and the vendor just, I guess they didn't analyze it right to begin with. A month down the road, all of a sudden it's like, oh shit, Captain F's going wild. You know.
I want to point out, Pam does look at it from an end user perspective. So we're not talking about vendors going, that's not important. I mean, just to clarify that.
Exactly,
okay, so
right.
So the end user doesn't analyze it properly. It doesn't really matter. I mean, you know, who's to really say the severity of the vulnerability at that point?
And that's another issue that we talked about this morning, too. What level of severity are we talking about when we're talking full disclosure? So when I say the little stuff, you know, that which exists but is not that pandemic that cannot cause such great havoc, if you will. So an exploit that's found, just like we used to see on BugTrack, you were talking about, those were the fun days. You know, everything was posted, choose it if you want, don't play with it if you don't want to. And the reality of it is, if any of you subscribed to BugTrack back then, it was constant all day long, right? That's not what I'm talking about. Don't bother me with that type of stuff. It's the high end that could disrupt service. Nationwide, internationally, kind of like SCADA could go down, you know, that which could, you know, impact life even. So it's not just about businesses operating. It's about utilities. It's about getting my money from the bank. So that's a situation that I think that we would need full disclosure for in order to control chaos and aftermath, if you will.
We actually talked about that this morning. So we talked a lot this morning.
Yeah,
for 7 a.m. We had a working assumption that if one person knows something, two people will. And so then it's a matter of attempting, for as best as is humanly possible, to monitor the situation as it develops to determine if, in fact, more than two people know or a customer or a situation is affected, so that we can see something that isn't truly exploitable. In fact, one of the points that Jerry just made about U.S. CERT is because they might actually be the first one to hear about a situation being exploited, typically, obviously, now it's known. One of the relationship areas that they've built quite a bit is with particular vendors to ensure that if they hear it as opposed to us, another source of information can inject it into our thinking, which says, you might not have heard, but now you need to know. It's no longer, quote, unquote, a secret.
That's the key thing. I mean, you know, if you do full disclosure, sort of BugTrack style on some truly apocalyptic vulnerability, you know, then, the cure may be worse than the disease in the sense that you get this thing out there and script kiddies start exploiting it and so on. At the same time, you don't want to delude yourself that only you and the original finder know something when that's not the case. And so, you know, I mean, one of the things we've done last year, 2 years, put a lot of investment and effort into situational awareness. Basically, what's out there, what's happening on the net, what are people we know seeing, is our assumption that this is a private report correct? Can't be perfect, but it's something you really have to put resources into.
This is probably a good segue into our second topic. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
What's interesting in several years of bug hunting and probably several hundred vulnerability reports to various vendors, in terms of them turning around and saying this was reported last week by another person, that's probably happened about 10 or 15 times. What I'd like to know is from like the vendor side is when a report comes into someone like Microsoft, for example, whether they have any data on that it's been reported by three or four separate people kind of thing. Based upon my experiences, I would guess that with a couple of minor exceptions, that the vast majority will be a single person reporting the flaw. But whether that has any relevancy on the actual working situation that we need to work to, i.e. if one person knows, let's assume, you know, two or more people know, whether that has any relevance on that is, well, I think it's irrelevant, but in terms of, is there an indicator, is there a pointer towards actual data on this? In my experience, you know, most of the stuff I report, I'm the only one who's reported it kind of thing. And I think the vendor data might lend itself to backing that up, potentially, I don't know. Well, we're talking about pre-disclosure here. Post-disclosure, you know, it's, you know, people will begin using it, you know. Correct, that's what I'm saying. It bears no relevancy on this situation whatsoever, other than, in my experience, everything I report, only occasionally, does someone else report the same thing. Correct. You're absolutely right. I don't dispute that. There could be the underground using it as well. The only data I can work with, though, is the data I have at hand, and that's what I have at hand, you know? But But by that stage, it's too late to make any accurate determination, because as soon as it's in the public. But then that's pre-disclosure. Correct, but that's what I'm saying. And until such time that you do know, there's stuff all you can do about it, really. No, so, that's the difficulty, I think. You know.
People find evidence of vulnerabilities and vulnerabilities being exploited without a priori knowledge of what the vulnerability is. I mean, you know, users still find anomalies. They may not say, you know, this is a vulnerability in xyz.dll, but they find things unusual happening. They report them to us, or, you know, to law enforcement, who brings them to us or what have you, on that basis, and then we're able to do the investigation and figure out what's really going on. I didn't.
But there's nothing to disclose if they don't know.
Right. What's your point? I'm trying to figure out what the point is. And if you don't know, you don't know.
Well, they're not told that there's a vulnerability that they're sitting on that they're not told about, so we can't actually look for evidence.
Well, you can't actually have a disclosure issue until you've got something to disclose. So if somebody knows something.
The
vendor knows.
Right. Well, it's that window when the vendor knows and believes that they and the individual researcher who has perhaps kept it quiet know, the period between that and when they start putting things out while they're working on patches, and certainly if that period extends to 9 months or years or whatever, that's a little bit ridiculous. But it, from the vendor perspective, it really is a question of, as best you can, you're trying to do a risk assessment on, is it likely to be quiet enough that it's better for customers to keep it quiet while I work on it and make the announcement when the patches are available, or tell the whole world about it and by so doing giving a pretty good indication of where the problem is and perhaps making it worse. It really is a risk assessment. And the best I think vendors can do at this point, and certainly you can discuss the possibility that maybe you ought to just announce it as soon as you know, even if there is no workaround and nothing to do, and figure that everyone was insecure anyway, you might as well make them publicly insecure. Versus, is it worthwhile to keep it quiet and hope?
Well, moderator's prerogative to jump to topic six, because you guys are running right in the middle of it. Let me just bring it up and let the panelists comment on this. What happens, because the atypical scenario that was being discussed is, you said it, the vendor knows it's a problem, a researcher knows it's a problem, but nobody else knows it's a problem. When should you disclose? So I would actually like to get, does anybody want to comment first, or I'm going to hit you all in order? There's a pretty vigorous discussion this morning. Where's Raven? Raven, what was your perspective on this? Should somebody disclose?
Well, it's going to be somewhat context dependent. You know, if it's, hey, hit a router with one packet, it goes down, I would really like for there to be a fix before that gets out there. When I am the researcher, I try and lean on the vendor to get that done and out there quickly. And in, you know, 7 years of doing this, I've only really had to get bitchy about it once. So normally I've had pretty good responses with that. If I feel that it's something that you have an option of whether to deploy it or not, it's less crucial that you find out about it. Like, you know, I would always want to know, but I realize that that's probably a more liberal perspective than many of my conservative financial clients who are like, shut up, which is why I'm not here with my company hat on. In particular, it can affect your decision of whether you want to use the technology and where, if you know that there is a flaw in it and it's remotely exploitable. For example, if I knew there was a remote exploit unpatched hole in OS X, that would make me absolutely certain that there is no way I'm putting my laptop on this conference wireless network. It can affect decision making, and that scales to a larger point of view.
Now, do we have any other perspectives, Scott? You work for an insurance company. Now, I know they're not stuffy or anything, but would you like to say, shut up, shut up?
It depends. I mean, there are always going to be circumstances. I think, in general, if the flaw in question has no viable fix, whether that's a patch or a workaround that includes the company continuing to function in a reasonable way, like turning it off is usually not a viable workaround. Sometimes it is, but usually it's not. Then I want to know personally, but it's not going to change the way that the operation is functioning in most cases. So, right, if there's not a viable workaround, so what the question then is, what's the value in the disclosure? If there's value in detection, perhaps, right, then maybe you can, maybe you can't. Right? That's not necessarily a foregone conclusion as knowing enough about the vulnerability that the exploit is always going to be detectable. Right? It may not be distinguishable. The prudent planning assumption at any point in time is that it is exploitable. You have to make that assumption. Because we know that every piece of software out there has had significant vulnerabilities in it. We know that new ones are found in significant pieces of software on a regular basis. You have to assume that there is a vulnerability in that software now that we don't know about and that somebody else does know about. You have to. You have to take that as you know. That's why you do defense in depth. That's why you segment systems. You have to assume that if this piece goes down, you're going to be able to contain the damage.
Well, I agree that that's a good approach to security design, to assume that any piece can get popped at any time. I think that there are things that you can do if you know that there's a flaw. Like a lot of the iOS upgrades that happened after last summer, some of the lower-end routers, they didn't have enough memory to take them, and so these people had to go out and buy new hardware. And you know, that's a decision you can make. Even if you don't have the budget now, you can start planning for it. You can lean on your vendor and say, hey, you know, support me here. I have this problem in your software. There's something you need to do about it. You know, they're not ideal steps, and they're not great steps, but they're at least something.
Yeah, I would also like to add, like, who's making the decision on whether or not there's no workaround, right? I mean, in that situation, if the vendor knows about it and the researcher knows about it, software is deployed in all kinds of different contexts. Some environments may be able to work around it, while others might not. And yeah, I don't know what the right answer is necessarily, but I think that that the assumption that there's no workaround automatically because it's an architecture problem isn't necessarily valid. And right.
I'm struck that nobody's commenting about the downside. If you do disclosure, there's additional risk because now more people will know about it. I mean, everybody's talking about the fact that, well, if one person knows it, two will know it, three, a handful, maybe a few. But when you do disclosure, the whole idea is no matter how many you do disclosure to, you have now released it to pretty much everybody.
And that's a key point right there. You know, we routinely come across vulnerabilities through a number of sources. You know, back to the question of how do you know it's being exploited? I mean, we leverage our capability to try to assess, you know, one, you know, we're interested from a national security critical infrastructure perspective, those type of angles. But we're also at the same time trying to see, is it specifically targeted? You know, we're working very closely with a vendor. We have, you know, pretty much in some instances daily phone calls with vendors. At the same time, you know, that they're looking and trying to monitor their sources, we're monitoring our sources. If we start to see a change or if we start to see some additional activity at that point, we assess, do we go ahead and communicate it or do we, you know, try to, you know, see, you know, confirm, you know, is it the same vulnerability or is it another twist to it? So, I mean, there's a number of things that go at play here. Again, if you just throw out there, you know, even under full disclosure, we put that information out there for signature creation to a broad audience very quickly, you know, people are going to turn around and take advantage of that information to create exploits.
The approach that we take is that it's not up to us to decide when to disclose, when it's appropriate. It's up to the customers, and that's why whenever we do a disclosure, we have the timeline in there. We let the world know when we told the vendor, and then they know when the patch comes out. And it's up to the customer. If the customer wants to talk to the vendor about that, if the customer wants to find a new vendor, they should. They should have the right to do that, and that's why we include that timeline.
A number of hands have shot up. Let me start with the guy at the blue shirt right there. Yes, you. That is blue, isn't it? Sorry.
Question is for Well, I can't comment directly on my own company, but I think that you would find in the majority of cases where these sort of custom applications are exposed via the network, for any software developer who is not regularly exposed to or has been regularly exposed to disclosure issues, that there will be difficulty in identifying the right person to talk to within that company. Right? The first report for any company is always the hardest, mm-hmm. right? Because the company is not set up for it. Very few companies, unless they happen to be security companies, before they release the software, say, oh, you know, if there's a security flaw in this, we should be sure that everybody knows how to get in touch with us. Right? It just doesn't. It's what? I'm not saying that the standards don't exist. I'm saying that it is very, very rare to find a company that has thought it through, of any kind. Right? It's not they exist. I'm sure they exist. If it's your company, great. But it's rare. Right? So that's the answer to your question. I think is that any company that you go to with a vulnerability who's not used to dealing with those kinds of reports, you're going to have a hard time dealing with it as a researcher, and the company is going to have a very hard time as the vendor taking in that information.
And I guarantee that even if you're set up for it, the first time really sucks.
Yep.
It doesn't matter. You can have the email addresses set up. You can have the web pages set up, and it's still going to be a clusterfuck the first time.
Yep. And the second time.
And the third and fourth and fifth.
The seventh is a little bit easier.
Comment over here.
The answer to that is it depends. Okay, I mean it's back to what we said before. If you're reasonably confident that it's you and the finder, and your other sources are tending to confirm that, then what you do, I'm assuming this is a really bad one, then you go like hell to get the fix built. We have this process Andrew Cushman referred to it this morning called SERP, Software Security Incident Response Process. We will typically mobilize that for watching, even on a private report of a really bad vulnerability, just to make sure that we're tracking on a daily or every couple of days basis. What's the status? Are we seeing anything? Is the support organization seeing things? There are other things that we can see. And the other thing is, if it's really bad, we'll build, basically an untested fix, okay, and have that ready to release if we feel we need to. Going out and saying, here's this awful vulnerability and we don't have anything to do for you with it. I mean, there are companies, there are organizations that can respond to a report like that. There are a lot more who can't. And who won't, and who won't know what to do with it, may not even hear of it, and won't, and will simply be put at risk by a report like that.
Let me take a quick poll of the audience. How many of you are end users? Raise your hand if you're an end user. Now, okay. Raise your hand if you're in a large enterprise and in charge of IT. Thank you. Okay, now, the thing is, of those of you that are end users, about a third of you, maybe a little more than a third of you, how many of you would like full disclosure if there's no fix available in spite of the risk that it represents? I said, it depends. Let me say, okay, we'll do it this way. We'll do it high, medium, and low. If there was low risk, but there's still risk by putting it out there, how many of you would want low risk of an actual, low impact of the attack? How many of you would be interested in full disclosure, even without a fix? How about if there was... Yeah, but unfortunately we're in a situation where you can't know about it until we disclose it.
So there's two types of risk you're talking about. One is the risk of the impact to your environment, and you're exactly right. We can't know the risk to your environment, and that can change hugely depending on your environment. There's also the risk of increasing the risk of something happening because of the disclosure, and that's one that you're. I mean, that's a holy war. That's no one's ever going to be able to truly know what the risk of going out with an announcement that there is an issue with such a piece of thing without knowing.
Well, I want to say, and it's part of full disclosure, that it's definitely an imperfect test, but I also want to reflect that only 20% of the end users really raised their hands. And just real quick, let's do the other half of it. Who does not want any type of disclosure unless there is a fix available? Okay, now how many of you didn't raise your hands at all? Probably about just as many. So a bunch of end users didn't pick either. Are you okay? Raise your hand if you're in the it depends camp. Okay, well now you're not even playing. All right, there's a guy over here who's jumping out of his tattoos. Are you with MITRE, sir? Are you with MITRE? Never mind. MITRE works on stuff like that. Just making sure you weren't shilling. Go ahead.
I'm sure there's only an answer there, but I'd like to take one crack again at the existence of a workaround prior to disclosure, if I could. And I'd be happy. I've been on panels and done many discussions about CVSS and would be happy to. But Sun has gone through some interesting changes, and things are a lot more open than they used to be. And I've had a number of epiphanies, and my world has changed an awful lot. And quite frankly, it no longer matters to us the existence of any sort of mitigating factors at all. My job, as I see it, and I'm sort of reinforced by the number of hands I'm seeing here, my job is, I believe, to assess whether or not it's better to not make the announcement because I believe that it really is as close to private as it can, or any evidence whatsoever that it is known outside of a small circle. And once I have any indication that it's known outside of a small circle, I believe it is my responsibility, and I've had customers tell me this because they want to have as much information as they can to do their own individual risk assessments, to go out with whatever information I have immediately, including possible potential workarounds, even if the workaround is unplug your box or grab your ankle.
Or just a candid ups. Derek, the other thing you can say is, to the best of our knowledge, there is no workaround at this time that we are aware. And part of what that sometimes does is actually generates interest in the community that says, hey, I'm creatively going to come up with an answer. That's just fine. But you're absolutely right. You end up assessing that position, and then at that moment you conclude whether or not you've just got to go out and say, look, now we believe it's actually placed enough highlight into that topic that we've got to let you know.
So the vendors seem to be leaving it around judgment as to how serious is the threat. Sir, did you finish your comments?
Sort of. I just kind of wanted to get the panelists and maybe the conversation that way towards, quantitatively value-wise the vulnerabilities and getting sort of a threat rating and whatnot. So, we'll get there. One point I wanted to bring up also that you seem to be talking about was when you're talking about, okay, we decided to go with the book, maybe not having a full work on it yet. And that part of the reason why you're doing that, right, is to enlist the aid of, panelists.
Yeah, I think we would agree there's no such thing as limited disclosure.
Yeah, speaking from the vendor side, I think it's been demonstrated in recent history that when large vendors do things that have the word security associated with them, a lot of people listen. And I'll just use last summer as an example. and it's that amplification factor, positively or negatively, which in many respects actually worries us, which is we can create undue attention onto something that can hurt our customers unintentionally by something like disclosure. So it's an incredibly hard line, and believe me, philosophically, we debate it probably more than just about any other topic. But I think there's a fair expectation to suggest that says that in the best of most scenarios, and certainly I think from anybody that's on the vendor side in this panel, our hope, if you will, where our hearts lie, is the idea that says that if we know to the best of our knowledge, and that can be flawed, and you can hold us accountable if we're wrong, but if we know to the best of our knowledge that there is a weakness in a product and that we can't come up with a way to fix it yet or it's in process, that we are attempting not to put you further at risk by drawing attention to it, by putting our name associated with the problem at large. That's the basic premise. Again, I think you have the right to know exactly where each one of your vendors stands in each one of those type of things.
The guy at the back with the hat.
Thank you. Two pieces. One is there should be some kind of acknowledgement. If you know the vulnerability, you should maybe not say exactly what it is, but you say, yeah, but we have acknowledgement, and this is the potential risk in this, and not disclose at all. Whether that's 2 weeks into it, and say, we're going to have a plan in 3 weeks, you address it. That lets the community know that you guys are on top of it. Because the undergrounds are exploiting those pieces. It's just not one person doing it. One person, one researcher knows about it, it's the underground that's exploiting it back in. That's what the fear is when you're talking about major companies and protection of that. So, from my angle, the full disclosure point, yeah, I want to be known. I at least want an acknowledgement that you know that ahead of time. So when it hits the papers, I have more trust in vendors than when it hits the papers and I have scrutiny and I'm looking to jump ship.
I know there's a lot of people in the audience who want to make comments. Are there any end users that want to jump up and say, no, I don't want to accept the risk? There was a bunch of hands back here. Anybody want to comment and say from an end user perspective, I don't want you to tell everybody if you don't have a fix? Well, go ahead.
There's a due diligence on the vendor side as well. If they don't have a reasonable, tangible way to deal with the problem, why exacerbate it? It's need to know.
Well, we've got one person in agreement and even more hands.
I think you could actually use borderline negligence to disclose certain things. I think that vendors have a legal duty to mitigate any potential of liability to their end users, and sometimes part of that mitigation means determining when or when not to disclose certain information. And I think that it can be a breach of that duty that the vendor has to their customer to disclose information that there is no reasonable or immediate solution for.
But do you think there should be a time frame around that? 9 months, 3 months, a week, what? I mean, I think there's, you know, to disclose or not to disclose and give the vendor time to prepare and determine can I fix it or can I fix it and what do I disclose. But should there not be a time frame around that? 9 months is an awful long time. I could have a baby in 9 months, right? It's a long time to wait to, you can't, but I could. But that's a long time to, you know, be working on something that is a huge situation. It's either way, to disclose or not to disclose, it's going to come out, right? Someone's going to find out, whether it's from the vendor, from my mother, you know, it's going to come out. So we need to think about not disclosing, but what we're going to say when we disclose and who's going to do the disclosing, because eventually it's going to have to be disclosed.
It's not necessarily going to come out.
Well,
there's plenty of stuff that's never been disclosed.
I don't know. Pam's mother's pretty lean.
I don't know. I mean, I think you also have to look at it from both sides on the negligence part, right? I mean, one of the things I think that's great about the natural tension between researchers and vendors is that it makes sure that vendors aren't too lax, and it makes sure that researchers aren't just blasting things out over the internet at willy-nilly, right? Because I think when you start talking and say, well, it's really hard to fix, I mean, what does that mean? Because I've worked with vendors where they say it's hard to fix, and really what they mean is it's hard to put out a patch. It's much easier if we wait till the next version, and that just happens to be Q107. Do you guys mind waiting? And it's hard to come back at that, right? It's what does hard mean? And I think that if there isn't that natural pull between the two forces, it gets very easy for vendors to say, well, we can wait because nobody knows about it. And that's just it's natural. It's not I don't think it's negligence necessarily on that side, but one could make a case just the same that you're saying that it is negligent to release the information, that it's negligent not to.
Bob?
I just point out that, you know, asking the top 10 customers, you know, is going to have the side effect of making numbers 11 through N really upset with us. And the other thing, maybe a little more seriously, is that I think most at least big vendors have enough of a sense of how, you know, the range of ways their systems are being used by customers so that they have a reasonable idea of, you know, sort of what the worst case is, even without that kind of feedback.
Yeah, yeah, part of the other part that we struggle with in order to address something like that is that, as many of you know, and part of the reason that we all want information is so that we can make a judgment call for ourselves on what to do. And unfortunately, what that would exacerbate is we would now, and I don't know many people that can really do this otherwise, we now have 10 customers that know ahead of everybody else in a way that, even though they're intending only to give us advice, it would be very hard for them not to look at their own corporations, and quite possibly irresponsible of them not to look at their own corporations and start changing something, at which point it then places a preferential treatment in such a position that would probably undermine the trust of a number of our own.
And actually, this is
I know where you're going, Bob. Don't misinterpret.
And this is actually a good segue into one of the other questions we had, which was, what about, you know, preferred lists of early notifications for some customers versus other customers? And I'll let John start because circumstances with
it. It was interesting because there was one of the discussions this morning was one of the panel members, and Michael, feel free and acknowledge that you said this. But he'll remain anonymous for the moment, he's run into situations in which, having worked with the vendor, and the vendor stated in no uncertain terms, we don't have preferential lists, that he then heard from, I think it was from a customer, that, hey, they knew about it. So in a sense, something in that closed loop didn't work, which was, if there's no preferential treatment, and somehow from the vendor information was given to a customer, then ostensibly that's a disconnect from policy. But here's my own personal position, and I'll reflect of Cisco's as well. I think the preferential treatment circumstantially can be necessary, but it's exceedingly, exceedingly small. And I'll give one example just by rights. But in a more general statement, at Cisco's policy, we don't have preferential stratification of customers. And I'll give you an example that's probably the most important. My team, I sit sort of as a vendor, and I also sit as a practitioner, and I've also got history and research. My team cannot, even with my knowledge, upgrade our own network on undisclosed, unfixed, or recently or soon to be coming out flaws. So I can't protect my own company with information my company has any differently than you. And the reason I think that's important is because it treats me as a customer equally to any of our others. And the only exception to that is if the very infrastructure that you're going to get the upgrades from has to be protected, so if it goes down, you wouldn't be able to fix yourselves either. And that's that narrow exception list in which there are times, and by the way, they don't even know enough to fill this hand, that the network infrastructure of the Internet or the network infrastructure in front of the software center that you all get our upgrades from would be at risk in a condition that it would be unavailable, at which point we do no good whatsoever other than to try and protect both of those, and that's the circumstance, and it's what we call critical notification. And again, that's such a rare circumstance that it it's frequently doesn't happen.
Yeah,
and I'm not even opposed to a preferential list. Like, that's, to me, that's something that's up to the vendor to decide if it's appropriate, and it's up to the customers to decide if they feel that it's appropriate. If you want to do it, that's fine. I think, though, there's a distinction between there's the formal list and the informal list, and it's actually the informal list that I'm less comfortable with. Formal list, you have control over it. You've made a decision that these people need to know for this business reason. That's cool. And, yes, to you know, state what you said earlier, yes, I've run into that situation. We toyed with when do we let our paying customers know and when do we let the vendor know. And we used to do it. We'd give the vendor some lead time, 2 days, 4 days, whatever it was. And ultimately, we went to a system whereby we let the vendor and our paying customers know at the same time because of that situation where we had issues where we would report it to the vendor, then we would report it to our customer, and they would come back and say, yeah, I already know about that. The vendor told me. I'd say, what? And it wasn't because it was the formal list. It was the informal. I mean, the reality is, you know, there's really valuable customers for software vendors, Citigroup, you know, Liberty Mutual, whoever, and somebody informally may give them that information.
Right, and I'll assert again what I said in the private session. If that happens in my company, I want to trace it all the way back to the source and introduce them to new career opportunities.
So
they can enjoy an increasing stock price.
Interesting. So.
Nice. It's 408. It's 408.
If you want to be on John's deferred list, there'll be a list in the back.
While John's answering his cell phone, let me just say that our practices are essentially the same as Cisco's in that regard. We don't have a preferential list, and we don't patch our IT systems. I don't think we've ever had it happen. We would patch Windows Update if we had to, for the obvious reason. But it's just too darn hard for practically or ethically or anything else to figure out where you draw that line. You wind up, everybody has a compelling reason mm-hmm. to be on the list of people who get to go to the head of the list. And
that is one of the most powerful things that we tell our customers, is when they understand that our internal networks are not on a preferential list, are not getting patched ahead of them getting the patch, it really does, as John said, it's we're in the same boat as our customers.
Yeah, but apparently I can call my own cell phone number and get on the list, so that's good news.
So I think it goes back to preferential lists, and you mentioned, you know, identifying some organizations or corporations that would, I don't want to use the word preferential, but would be made aware of the situation prior to others. And in those situations, I would see that which provides the service that you need in order to push the patches or give the upgrade. So like an internet service provider, you would need them perhaps to assist you, and they would be made aware of the vulnerability that exists so that they could, one, patch, and two, push to the rest of the world. Is that, right. Is that the assumption that we're making?
It is. And then, in fact, you always know when it happens
right.
because you just look at the peering points reset and you pretty right. much assume that we're doing something.
Right. And I was on
like
both sides of that.
Hidden.
Working for an ISP yeah. previously, as Josh Fritz, who's over there in the corner, did as well, which was something that gets you back to it gets out. So when we at the ISP that I worked for knew about it, we were perceived as being on a preferential list, which does not exist. I'm by no means trying to defend any of the vendors here, but the point that I'm trying to make is that sometimes you do have preferred releases just to support the rest of the community, which in my world makes sense. Even though I'm not in the ISP world anymore, I certainly want them to be able to sustain it when I need it to download it.
But that only touches on the vendor aspect. And I know, you know, we talk, you know, obviously we know what iDefense's policy is. There's a lot of companies that actually are in the business of buying vulnerabilities. You know, one of our questions was, at what point do they notify the vendor? You know, essentially their customer base is a preferred list, so, you know, people subscribe to these services to get that advance warning. And I'd be interested just in also general comments from the audience along those lines.
That's a paid-for service, though. It's totally different.
I'd like to offer up one point, though, that I think was subtly messaged a minute ago, which is I'll just use my own company. Somebody says, I told Cisco a year ago. Okay, who in Cisco is a key part? I love my salespeople to death as long as they keep making revenue and bookings. However, they may not be the right and most qualified person to understand the very technical thing that you just told them in order to relay it over to the right group of people. So the earlier comment about RFC standards and who to contact, I think that's really, really, really important, which is you got to have a consistent technique as a vendor by which to hear that information, and absent that being used, you're right, you did tell Cisco, but Cisco is 48,000 people, and you might not have told the CERT, which is our incident response team, and that's the only group that you should have told.
Yeah,
so
and
that's really important, too.
I brought it up this morning that I think that in this process, there are obligations that the vendor has, and there are obligations that the researcher has. And I think that a really important obligation that the vendor has is to make it easy to get that information and have a consistent process and a team dedicated to it. And I mean, fortunately now, most of the big companies do, not all companies do, which is a huge change from, say, 5 years ago. But that is a fundamental obligation on the part of the vendor, is to make sure that there is a process in place.
You in the back there standing up with a black T-shirt?
Yeah, we did talk about that this morning, and one of the things that I sort of shook my fist at the vendors for in a kind, polite, loving way was that it's important to have that honesty so that people can make their own risk assessments, can know when a patch is really important to roll out. One of the major failures last summer was that there was a patch out for the Cisco Gate stuff, and no one knew it was important, no one installed it, and so all of a sudden, boom, in 2 weeks, everyone is scrambling to upgrade the whole internet because, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God. Well, at least something with the patch to say, hey, this is...
They should have a workable communication method with their customers. Whatever their standard method of communicating with their customers is, I believe they ought to have one, and they ought to make it known that their customers who are going to pay attention to security know how to get that information.
Who doesn't get the talking about you don't have Microsoft to tell you what the updates are going to be?
If you only get software, everyone will let out. Right next to the piece of software is an extra of the release unit. If the customer doesn't need the release unit, that's
the end. Okay. Right. Yeah. I mean, can we have a question over here on the left? Yes, you. Okay. Excuse me, we have a question over here on the left. Could you please stop or leave the room?
My question is actually about preferential treatment and making it actually slightly different for packet transport, like you know, network equipment providers. But like Cisco, are you saying that there's not an idea of something like a skitter core where a group of backbone providers you notify before all others because they have to provide the infrastructure for everyone to upgrade their devices?
You're absolutely right, except in the circumstance that that network infrastructure in a very, very tightly controlled process that we go through would actually be completely at risk. So, for example, many of the vulnerabilities we release affect ISPs, but will it actually destabilize their core every single time? No, mostly because of everything from, for example, the fact that you've got multi-redundant pathing throughout the Internet to the fact that we're not the only vendor on the Internet to et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But if you take something like TCP/IP, you know, the V4 wedge problem, or the SNMP, you know, vulnerabilities back in the ASN1 days, that can affect multiple vendors, which would affect then all paths, and then we run into a very different problem, which is now we're all in a position where we're going to have to actually take care of the infrastructure, to your point. Absent that, though, no. And by the way, some of the largest customers we have don't exactly like hearing at the same time as the smallest customers. But we figure that as soon as there's a preferred list, everybody will get signed up onto it. By the way, 405-555-1212. And then there's no preferred list again. So it's just a deathly cycle to get into.
Well, like with the TCP windows, I mean, slipping something in a TCP window, right? And so everyone should enable TCP/IP, for example. And a select core provider were notified of that sort of, you know, that vulnerability. And they start enabling this and resetting sessions. And it's visible to everyone else. And they're saying, oh, there's some problem with TCP/IP. And so they decide whether they should upgrade or what they should do without enough information.
Well, and you'll notice that that window was, I think, I'd have to quote Russ, but it's probably something like 48 hours before the information's out anyway. So it's the window is exceedingly small, and that's part of that process that we go through, which, by the way, is the hardest one for us to go through, is when to do it. And it's also with the assurance that the information is going to be public very quickly. In fact, many times in concert, because it's multi-vendor, if not as a subjugate to what U.S. CERT's announcement schedule will be for it, because it is a multi-vendor problem, of which we are just one. And it does us no good for Cisco to come out and go, hi, we fixed this multi-vendor problem first, and now Juniper just learned about it. I mean, in public press. I mean, that's just... That would be an awful thing for us to go through, and we won't do it. So.
Okay, we have about, I think, 5 more minutes. So we'll take one or two more questions over here.
Real quick question. Will U.S. CERT go on the record and comment if they share their information with anyone, and if so, who?
So I take it you're not one of our subscribers then. did you take that first step and actually sign up?
That was pretty good.
So, no, I mean, we do, you know, we have the technical and non-technical cyber alerts, and we do have a number of vehicles for getting access to that information. So, you know, you're talking about pre-disclosure?
Yes.
Again, you know, if we're seeing, you know, active exploitation, or we see something and the vendor might not have the patch fully baked or might not be where it needs to be, we're going to go ahead and communicate that. So, but we're going to let the vendor know that we're going to do that, so they can, you know, take the appropriate steps. As you heard, you know, Steve touch on, sometimes they have a patch that's ready to go. It's not fully tested. But, again, that also helps grease the skids and moves the vendor along a little bit faster, too, when we give them that notification. But we are actively looking to see if there is activity related to a vulnerability.
And more specifically, someone reports a vulnerability to you rather than the vendor. Do you share that with them, size the vendor up until the disclosure point?
It's one of those, it depends. So, you know, again, you know, we have, you know, so basically, you know, when we get something, we're going to quickly take a look, you know, from a national security and a homeland security perspective. And basically, this is our own triage, so I'll get to that. But basically, you know, we've got sources to also take a look and see, you know, are we seeing any related activity. Of course, we're going to do some validation. And we're going to be working very closely with the vendor right off the get-go, because we also need their help to help validate this. And I know in a lot of instances where we worked with the vendor, based on what a security researcher found, they might find one angle or one vector, and it's actually, you know, obviously to a bigger problem or a bigger issue, or there's another way to take advantage of a vulnerability. So, I mean, there's a lot of steps that come into play.
I don't know if you could hear Tom's question. Oh, yeah.
Okay. The question was, where else does it go aside from U.S. CERT if you report something to U.S. CERT?
Besides the vendor. So, you know, again, back to all this discussion we just had on disclosure, you know, we're working very closely with the vendor. At the same time, you know, we're also trying to pay attention to what's out there. We're very concerned about leaking the information ourselves, because we don't want to create the problem of exploit tools and things being developed. Right. Within, you know, we've got a small government circle of folks that we work with as well, so pretty much.
See,
it's back to it depends. So, I mean, there's a number, you know.
That's really interesting, because it seems there's a lot of hostility towards,
that, so.
You know, giving it to, from a U.S. perspective, giving it to government organizations and then, you know, feeding it within that government, like, area. In the U.K., I've got no problem with that. If I find a bug, the first person I tell about is CESG and NICE in the U.K. kind of thing, you know, because my own independent security relies on national security, and that means I'll give this information to, you know, the powers that be in Britain, you know. It seems like there's a divide, well, obviously other than the ocean, you know, between the way we see these things, you know. So.
Well, I don't really.
Would you give it to the U.S. government, though?
Yes, I'm quite happy to.
At the same
to.
Time as you.
Yeah, I'm quite happy to do that, and we do that.
Would you give it to the Indian government, French? I mean, you see,
Western interests. Western interests, mate.
Okay. No, I was just more curious.
Okay, I just want to clarify something.
I don't mind
here.
Where your position is. I was just curious what it was.
Tom wasn't having. I'll speak for Tom. His thing wasn't that you're giving it to the government that's bad. It was who else are you giving it to? And then,
sure.
and then the answer was it's the government pretty much. And I think the question for me is to like, well, so like, what's an example? I could see how other vendors get it, right? You have a vulnerability, and maybe it's a multi-vendor issue, and you don't know it. So you have to.
Yeah, right.
One, two. Talk to Jerry afterwards. Okay, I'm afraid we're out of time, so we can't take any more questions. Thank you all for coming, and thank you to all of our panelists.
Great. Thanks, David. Great job.
Thank you, Paul.